Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. This is our last week for the year. On Wednesday will be our last episode for 2022, and we will be back, I think, the second week of January. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Mlondi Mdluli. Mlondi, how are you doing, man?
Good afternoon, Nick. I'm good, and you? It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
Excellent. No, I'm pretty good. Tired. I think all of us have kind of, we can see the end of the year in sight, and so we're sort of scrambling towards it as one does. We're also joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing, sir?
I'm tired.
Yes, no, I think that's the feeling. But nonetheless, we will do our best to entertain, enlighten, and delight our listeners today. And let me start off with, we don't normally start off with foreign news stories, but this year, this episode, we're going to be starting off with a foreign news story because I think this is a pretty big deal. And that is that China is seeing an enormous number of protests, which, and not just enormous number of protests, but enormous number of protests in some of the major economic hubs and the major economic hubs that, and protests that have also gotten a lot of foreign media attention. There are often protests that go on in China, but due to the very closed nature of Chinese society and the state's very tight grip on information, information about them usually doesn't reach the outside world until much later. Well, in the streets of Shanghai and as well as Beijing and dozens of university campuses, there were a large number of protests, which has been unprecedented in China since Xi Jinping, the current president of China, assumed power 10 years ago. And these protesters, while being interviewed by foreign journalists, said, quote, "We hope to end the lockdown. We want to live a normal life. We should all bravely express our feelings." So lockdown in China has been a little bit more, you know, there's been a lot of frustration caused by the COVID lockdowns in the rest of the world. But in China, it was on another level. The state has set up this incredible complex web of monitoring. Everyone has to be tested for COVID constantly. People are quarantined off against their will for sometimes weeks at a time if they fail a test. You're not allowed to enter stores at various times. Neighborhoods and cities have been entirely shut down, with people not even allowed to go out of their apartments to buy food more than, say, sort of once a week because of COVID lockdowns. So it's been pretty intense, and it's not surprising that this has finally bubbled out into some outrage, I think. One of the interesting things about this story is that there were a lot of foreign journalists there to witness it, because, of course, the foreign journalists tend to hang out in places like Beijing and Shanghai. Now, to be a foreign journalist in China, you need to be properly accredited by the Communist Party. They don't just, you know, let you show up because China is such a closed society. And I think quite to the shock of the sort of foreign journalist crowd, a Reuters journalist was detained for about 90 minutes by the Chinese police, and a BBC reporter claims that he was arrested, beaten, and then dragged off to a prison cell where he was kept for about, I think, a whole night by the Chinese police, who just assumed he was a protester. The foreign ministry of China simply responded to the BBC reporter's accusations by saying he did not identify himself as a journalist, so really it's his fault. With regards to the protests themselves, China's foreign ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian said, when asked a question about the anger about COVID protests, said, "What you mentioned does not reflect what actually happened. We believe that the leadership of the Communist Party of China and the cooperation of Chinese people are fighting against COVID-19 will be successful," which is fairly sort of standard speak for the Chinese Communist Party. So, Mlondi, let me start with you. I think it's, you know, it's kind of a big deal. You know, we know in China that people's freedom of speech is heavily repressed. There's an enormous amount of control that the government exercises over people. But usually foreign journalists don't face the same kind of activity. And to see a journalist from one of the world's biggest news corporations, that being the BBC, taken away and beaten by the cops, I mean, that seems like it's pretty significant. What's your take on this, Mlondi?
Yes, Nick. Well, this is clearly a This is clearly a a problem, Nick, because as you know, as you've just said, you know, like in the past, we've never seen something like this, or like we've never heard of something like this, you know, been happening to a journalist, you know, from another country. So, you know, so it's very shocking, and you know, I just feel for the people that you know that actually live there, because you know they are suffering the most. Because if they can do that to a foreign journalist, then just imagine how you know how they're treating their own citizens. So it's very concerning. It's definitely concerning.
No, definitely. Terence, you lived for a while in Taiwan. You have had quite a lot of interaction with you have some strong views on the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Republic of China. What's your take on these protests? Is this really the beginning of something bigger, or is this just going to sputter away? Apparently, according to the reporting, there don't seem to have been major protests in Shanghai and Beijing this morning. So perhaps they have been squashed for now. But what's your view of all this?
Look, I think that the you can read too much into the wider potential of this. The Chinese have a next level security state, and if the Chinese Communist Party sends a real threat to its power, they would know how to swoop in and deal with those troublesome individuals. That being said, I think that this shows a more subtle breakdown. The basic socio-political bargain in the Chinese system is that you don't get much of a public life, but you get a fulfilling private life, or you know your ability to make money, to you know live your own life, to have opportunities for personal upliftment and whatever. That's kind of the trade-off. So you know that, and that's why something like the social credit system seems to have at least a surprisingly large level of societal endorsement. You know, if I'm not doing anything wrong, then this is fine. It'll keep order, and you know, then I can have my own life, and you know, my kids will have a better future and whatever. I think that what COVID has shown is that can bring that kind of bargain to a halt. China's an extremely closed off society, but I find it hard to believe people, particularly in the more open parts or the more outward facing parts like Shanghai and Beijing, are not aware that these restrictions are being lifted elsewhere in the world, and it's you know just becoming part of the health landscape that you have to deal with. To be shut down, to miss opportunities for education, which is an extremely important thing for middle class and aspirant Chinese, to find your material circumstances foreclosed by restrictions and disruptions, and also just not to be able to have those personal pleasures that kind of make China's new prosperity all you know worthwhile. You know, going and sitting in a park with your friends, or playing you know table tennis out in your complex's front yard. So yes, you know, it's not, to my mind, a revolt against the government. I don't think it has any sort of impetus for that to happen in China. You'd have to have the military and security services are revolting, and I don't see any indication of that. But it's one of these things that may well you know force some sort of adjustment. Because of the nature of its totalitarianism, citizens do have a certain degree of leverage. You know, their role in the whole pantomime is to be happy, and if you are transparently not happy, then your national narrative, that you know, just doesn't look convincing. So yes, I think some people are gonna face a very harsh reckoning, when the cameras go off. But this is also something that I think in a Chinese way can shift the envelope slightly on certain peripheral issues, like the approach to the approach to the lockdown. But this is not to my mind, a replay of Tiananmen Square.
Right. On that last point, there have been some signs in some of the protests across the country, because these weren't just in the big cities, they were also in a couple of places around the country. And in some of the protests, people chanted anti-government slogans. People chanted anti-Xi Jinping in particular slogans, which is really unusual. And Terence, if I may stick with you, the central question, I think, of geopolitics in the 21st century is it going to be the Chinese century? And I would say that while in the year 2008, 2010, there was a lot of reason to think that that is going to be the case. But I think in the year 2022, these protests, the zero COVID lockdown policy, and Xi Jinping's increasing authoritarianism or increasingly centralized grip on power seems to be maybe undermining China's attempts to assume global leadership. What do you make of that argument, very briefly?
Well, look, I think that there's a couple of things going on. I think that probably more significantly is that the way it handled the initial outbreak caused enormous mistrust amongst countries with competing political systems, but which had pragmatic relationships. I'm thinking here of Australia, for instance, Japan, India. You've had this quad arrangement, the AUKUS treaty, and a country like Australia has been willing to actually take quite an economic hit to take a geopolitical stand on this. There's also been and someone with personal links to an admiration for Taiwan as a beleaguered democracy. It's been quite heartening for me to see that they seem to have an audience now, which they didn't have a decade ago. I think that for China, possibly the one of the more strategic threats is the is finding itself not if I wouldn't say excluded, because I don't think that's accurate, but finding its place in world supply chain somewhat more questioned. I mean, and there are the other factors behind that. Labor costs are rising, so it's possibly easier to well, there are industrialists looking at putting factories in Vietnam, for example. There are big issues with intellectual property piracy, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing is that China's got a severe demographic problem. It's one child population brought the policy brought the population growth down.
Right, I believe it's one of the fastest aging societies in the world now.
Yeah, so look, I mean, I think that but it's still an extremely large and powerful player. And I just hasten to say that if you look at if you look at world history just prior to the Second World War, in hindsight, so countries like Germany and Italy, Japan, just were not really in a position to prevail. They didn't have the industrial base, the population, the infrastructure to conduct a war on that scale. But with a correct series of blows, they could at least be extremely damaging, and perhaps if they played their cards smarter, the results could have been very different. We might be living in a very different world. So I don't know. I think that for me, China probably has a certain window of opportunity. And although I don't believe that it will be the Chinese century, I think the question is, in 100 years' time, are we looking at a world where the Chinese example has become something that turns liberal democratic alternatives into just one of many normatively equal propositions on a on a smorgasbord, and that does concern me.
That's very interesting to think about. Okay, let us jump then to our next topic. And sorry, Terence, I'm going to stay with you again because you've written a really interesting piece today that has been published on the dailyfriend.co.za titled Diversity, Deliberation, and Difficult Conversations. So, Terence, do you maybe want to tell us a little bit about what you wrote about and your sort of argument here?
Well, this being South Africa, we see one of these controversies arising every couple of months, every couple of weeks. Someone says something untoward, uses, as I say, one of our talismanic race words, and we can see a flurry of outrage. Now, without justification. The problem is how do we deal with it? And I was particularly intrigued by the events at Fisher Oak High School, which I think have featured on the show, and particularly what the diversity consultant, hence the diversity thing in my title, had to say about this in a radio interview. She said comments to the effect of, well, as South Africans, we don't have a common definition of racism, and people are still using, quote, the outdated definition, which is about individual acts. This is about structures and systems and whatever. And, this is phrased invoking the word diversity. And my sense of this all is that that diversity actually is something that that people must get used to and get used to managing. We 100 years ago, 200 years ago, you might live your entire life within 10 kilometers of the place where you were born and associate with the same people over that period, most of whom come from a very similar background. That's not the case anymore, particularly if you live in an open society. So, you can forget whether this is good or bad. This is just a reality. It's I think good to talk about our differences. But I think that what's happening where we have these racial instances and we call in the diversity industry, what you end up with is something that uses the term diversity to get but get it of any substance. I don't think that dealing with let's say racial diversity is a particularly difficult issue. Certainly not if you want to match it against, let's say, linguistic diversity, where we struggle to understand each other's languages. Now, I lived in Taiwan and I tried, but I could never get a handle on Mandarin. I think also there is a diversity of thought, and this is where I see Ms. Nguo Sheng, talking about diversity, but then saying, well, we don't really need diversity. I'll tell you what to think. We all think that way. We can have a discussion. A concept like structural racism, for instance, let's leave aside an assessment, but it is an intellectual construct, and as such, it is something that can and I think should be critiqued. But if you simply say, well, this is the truth, then you indicate there is no scope for such diversity. So what I went on to say is that if we are serious about this, if we are serious about having those, quote, difficult conversations, that actually means you have to allow such difficult conversations to take place, not try and sort of shut them down on the basis that, there's a certain line that, all decent people are required to hold. And, I as the contracted diversity consultant will ensure that you understand and obey. We actually need to have the sort of exchanges where someone can say, well, I think this is benign, but someone else might think this is deeply offensive. See, I think people on all sides of this can become extremely defensive, and I think it becomes very counterproductive. To say someone is, well, you're too sensitive, Well, you know, I don't know what that person, what that person's gone through, what that person's, you know, personal or family history is. Maybe, you know, there are good reasons for that sensitivity. Now, I make the point. This is difficult stuff. I mean, this is my inner Jordan Peterson. You know, this is difficult stuff, man. We are not always going to agree, and sometimes we are going to just find an incoherence where we're two of us just see things very differently. And you know, that's, I don't have an easy answer for, you know, for where that goes, but at least if we can acknowledge that we are in a position somehow to at least consider how we move forward. That's why I say deliberation, not dictation.
No, I really liked your bit of the piece there, which I will put in the links in the comments below, where you talked about how, you know, difficult some of these discussions may have been, but conversation doesn't seem to be really a feature of a lot of them.
No.
Mlondi, your thoughts on what Terence has written and this whole issue of the kind of diversity consultant?
Yes, Terence. Well, good piece, Terence. First of all, and I don't want to say, you know, because I don't want to mince my words when it comes to those who these diversity consultants. They're just here to cause a confusion. They're not here to solve the problem. They're here to cause more problems and cause more confusion. So, yeah, like they're more of like dictators, as Terence, put out. So, like, so like they want you to think, you know, a certain way, and like say, you know, certain things, you know, and then like we show that you don't really, agree with them, and then that's a problem. So they're not here to solve any problem. They're here to cause more problems, and they're here to cause more confusion. So yeah, I don't miss my words.
No, exactly, because you know, if you're a very cynical type of person, the worst thing you can do if you're a problem-solving consultant is to solve the problem, because then you'll be out of work. Okay, let's move on to our last topic for today, and this is also another interesting sort of story. You know, the topic is statues, race, colonialism, but it's not about South Africa. It's about our neighbors to the north, Namibia. Although I suppose all of our neighbors except Lesotho are to the north. Anyway, in Namibia in the 1960s, there was a statue put up in Windhoek municipality outside the new municipal headquarters at Kaiser Street, which is now called Independence Avenue, that recognized a German officer and administrator of the city of Windhoek in the 1890s, who the Germans claimed was a founder of the city of Windhoek. And he was a really important guy in the early colonial occupation by Germany of the region. He arrived as a governor there, I think, only a few years after Namibia had essentially been taken over by the Germans. Anyway, this guy, his name was Kurt von Francois. It was an interesting name because he sort of obviously seems to have had some French origins. And he was a trained geographer who made a career in advancing Germany's colonies in the region. And he was also in command of a small military unit of Schutztruppe, who were sort of stormtroopers of the German colonial administration. So his statue has been up since 1965 in Windhoek, and it's caused quite a lot of controversy because some people say, firstly, that he sort of stole the glory for establishing the city of Windhoek, which some history say was in fact founded by, I think, a Nama leader who created a settlement there first. And a petition was signed where about 1,500 people asked for the statue to be taken down, and it has now been removed by the government. The online petition said, quote, "While we cannot change our city's dark and violent history, we can change what we commemorate from that history." Interesting thing, though, about this von Francois guy is that when he left the country in 1894, so that's before the German colonial genocide against some of the Namibian people, and while he was in Namibia, he actually married a local princess called Amelia Arkas from the Damara community in the area. So, Lonnie, I guess the first thing to talk about here is, you know, is this really what the politics of Namibia should be focusing on? What's your thoughts there?
No, Nick. Yes, I'd say no. They are focusing on all the wrong things because I'm sure that they don't have a healthcare system, and you know, and also that their economy, you know, it's not doing well. So those are the issues that you know that they should be focusing on, and not statues. So sure, they have taken down the you know like the statue, but has that their problems changed? No, they still have the same problems that they you know that they're facing. It hasn't changed much, and so I would say that they shouldn't really be focusing on this really.
So Terence, as Mlondi says, you know, this is the kind of emotive issue which gets people really fired up, but doesn't necessarily actually kind of move the ball forward on a lot of the issues that people, you know, are most important to their lives.
Hmm.
What's your take on this story?
Okay. First of all, I think Mlondi's right in the sense that that there are more important things to worry about. And Namibia, has had a rough couple of years, like, you know, constant recession and that sort of thing. But that being said, I don't think that this sort of politics of memory or symbolic stuff is necessarily entirely unimportant. But for me, this is actually quite a good example of the kind of thing you need deliberation about, because ultimately, at the end of the day, in a situation like this, it will come down to either that statue will be there or it won't. So it's, I think it's very, very important for people standing on either side to be able to articulate clearly their position, why they believe one thing or the other. Now, from what I can see, it doesn't seem to be a great deal of support for retaining it, and I think that they've moved it to what they call the old fort, which is where they've taken a lot of the German colonial relics, and it's kind of a museum. And you know, maybe that's a decent endpoint. I found his life history interesting. You know, as you say, yes, he was instrumental to the conquest, but he also seemed to be okay enough with the locals that he was prepared to marry and have a child with one.
Left before the genocide, which is also marked in his favor.
Look, I think that your visible heritage, it's always a complicated thing. The way that we see any sort of given any given icon will change from generation to generation. I often think that you can actually learn more about what a particular statue or block or whatever tells you about the people who put it up than about the people or event that it's commemorating. And personally, I like statues. I like visible heritage, and I find very interesting where you can see multiple levels of sort of awareness and ideology that go through. European cities are actually fascinating for this. But you know, once again, not everyone is going to see it in my terms. You know, for maybe people who have personal family recollections of the Herero genocide or whatever, for whom that is the only association that they're going to have. I mean, I once said, and this probably sounds very idealistic, that when you have to make that sort of choice, then where it's there or not, there's two rules. First of all, you don't destroy anything. You accept that whatever was there has some value in memory or in sentiment or for whatever reason, or could grant that acknowledgement and grace. Secondly, I think that those who feel that what they have lost, because there is because the other side has prevailed, you know, give it gracefully and hope that it can be taken to another place where it can be respected in, you know, in a different context. And for those who have succeeded, do not be triumphalist, you know, except that, you know, sometimes in any relationship, sometimes there may be a winner or a loser, and accept that you, we're losers because Eskom just put our lights out. Accept that, what we are sometimes called to do is to show, grace and humility to those who have, sacrificed or have had something taken away from them. You know, this is, to my mind, not about politics, but it's about how a community functions.
Definitely something to think about. Okay, so that is all the discussion that we will have for today. Thank you very much for listening. As I said, Wednesday will be our last episode of the year. I hope you all have a fantastic and interesting, wonderful day, and we'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.